Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Alan Adams. I'm a member of the Board of Governors of the National Press Club and an editor with a business newsletter, Research Recommendations. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you who are listening on C-SPAN or watching on C-SPAN and listening to the program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. On Thursday, July 8, Marvin Runyon, Postmaster General of the United States. On Friday, July 9, opera singer Jose Carreras will discuss his battle with leukemia and the work of the Carreras Leukemia Foundation. And on Wednesday, July 14, Secretary of Health and Human Services, Donna Shalala. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include Secretary of Transportation, Federico Pena, and the Director of the National Hurricane Center, Dr. Robert Sheets. Audio and video tapes of the Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. With unemployment in America hovering around 7% for months, real income down for several years, and companies cutting payrolls by the thousands every week, who in their right mind would go on strike? In fact, when is the last time you can remember a big strike in America? It almost came to pass this spring when the United Mine Workers Union, once as potent a force in the American labor front as any, began a selective strike against the nation's coal producers. To date, the strike involves only 14,000 workers in six states. Yet it has hardly made headlines or appeared to cause concerns at the nation's coal-burdening utilities, steel mills, and other manufacturers. Yet this strike is certainly unusual. One thing is for sure. American labor has appeared a lot more timid about strikes since the early 1980s, when former President Ronald Reagan redefined labor management relations by giving management a solid upper hand. Americans will be watching this fall to see if the UMW scenario repeats itself when the big three domestic automakers and the United Auto Workers begin serious discussions about a new work contract. The UMW strike begs the question, however, will America's labor unions ever regain the strength for workers they once had, or are unions a dying institution? Our guest today, Rich Trumka, president of the United Mine Workers Union, is ideally suited to address that question. He is fresh from a strike and the bargaining table. He is part of the young generation of labor leaders tackling the myriad challenges trying American labor's mettle. Rich Trumka is a third generation coal miner, starting work at age 19 in the Pennsylvania coal mines after finishing high school. In the early 1970s, he earned a Bachelor of Science degree in accounting and economics from Penn State University, and later a law degree from Villanova University. He was first elected president of the United Mine Workers in November 1982. He was reelected in 1987 and won a third five-year term last November. For those who think labor unions are on their last leg, Mr. Trumka says, think twice, then think again. Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Trumka, President of the United Mine Workers of America.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. I appreciate that very much. Reg, thanks for inviting me. You know, the other day I was reminded that it isn't very often that union presidents speak at the National Press Club, And there's a reason for that, of course. And I think it's the same reason why a lot of unions only judge their press strategy to be successful when reporters finally give up calling. Or as one union flack once told me, my job isn't to get my president's name in the paper, my job is to keep it out of the paper. Well, I'd like to think that over the past several years, union leaders have begun to adjust their attitudes a little bit, and that most of us in the labor movement today have come to understand that it's always in our members' best interest, and really in the country's best interest, for unions to become more accessible to the news media. That if working families are going to play the part that we need to and have a right to in helping to shape the kind of change this country is so hungry for, then we need to tell our story. And that's really why I'm so proud to have been invited here to be with you this afternoon. Because I think that at this moment in our nation's life, that the story of the labor movement, the story that we have to tell, the message that we have to share, can have special meaning in the lives of millions of Americans who have never even set foot in a union hall or cast a vote on a contract ratification. Because more and more the story of my unions and others all across the country is one of hope and change for an America which seems to have lost control of its economic destiny. It's a story of empowered workers and industrial renewal, a story of changing the culture of the American workplace to win new opportunity and new security for labor and management and the communities that we live in as well. And how difficult and painful making those changes happen really is. Now, we all know about the part of the story that's happening here in Washington, D.C. We hear a little about it in the debate over striker replacement legislation, or whenever the White House or the Labor Department says something about labor law reform, or whenever the NLRB issues a new ruling. But I have to tell you that from where I stand, the real story about unions and workers in the 1990s isn't unfolding here so much as it is in places like Dora, Alabama, and Grayville, Illinois, and Lynch, Kentucky, and in little coal towns clinging to the hillsides in West Virginia, or tucked away in valleys all across southwestern Pennsylvania. Go there, and you'll hear still coal mining men and coal mining women talk about an America that you don't come across too often in this town. You'll hear stories of people working miles beneath the surface of the earth, sometimes waist deep in bone-chilling water. They'll tell you what it's like to listen for the creaking and the popping that the roof generally makes before it's about to cave in on you. And how you can never afford to forget that one brief moment buildup of methane and one spark could at the very least burn you and your buddies half to death. Now that's the world of the coal miner. It's a world where you go to work each day knowing that the coal dust that you'll suck into your lungs is going to come back to haunt you and leave you old and bedridden with a disease called black lung. Ask any coal miner, and they'll tell you it's hard work and it's dirty. But ask any coal miner, and they'll also tell you it's honest work, that it puts food on the table, that it keeps a roof over their family's head. The men and women who mine America's coal take a tremendous amount of pride in the fact that we mine coal better than anyone in the world. Almost 1 billion tons of it in 1991. And since the early 80s, UMWA miners have increased productivity over 200%. We've cut costs. We've increased efficiency. And because of it, American coal is still the choice of American coal users. Not imported coal, but American coal. In fact, we export upwards of 100 million tons of coal every year. Now, productivity up, efficiency up, exports up, we ought to be an American success story. But don't tell that to Greg Yankee. Greg lives in Tridelphia, West Virginia. Now, let me just tell you a little bit about Greg. He works up at the Shoemaker No. 9 coal mine. It's an underground mine owned by Consol Energy. Now, most folks outside the coal fields haven't heard of Consol, but it's the second largest coal company in America. It's co-owned by DuPont and a German company called Rheinbraun AG. And the 1980s were tough on Greg. In fact, he was laid off for more than 4 years. And a lot of people he works with, folks now in their early 40s, well, they were in the same boat as Greg. Greg and his co-workers understand competitiveness in a way that I think few others really do. Now, Shoemaker Mine isn't a new mine, but thanks to miners like Greg, it's been setting production records for every year. And all that hard work has paid off handsomely for Consol. UMWA miners produced more than 77% of Consol's coal in 1991. In fact, 10% of DuPont's total profits that year came from coal mined at Consol by folks like Greg. But while Greg and the coal miners up at the Shoemaker No. 9 mine were busting their backs, Consol was breaking its promises. You see, back in 1988, Consol and the other coal companies, companies like Peabody, Arch Minerals, Ziegler, Ashland, promised that 3 out of every 5 new jobs at their mines would be set aside for workers like Greg. Now, that's a crucial issue for us, because when we increase our productivity, we lose our jobs that much faster. See, there's only so much coal you can never take out of a coal mine. And the average amount of coal remaining in the mines where UMWA members like Greg work is 7 years' worth right now. After that, the mine closes. Now, we hoped that after making that agreement with Consol and the other coal companies would not only put the job security issue behind us, but had managed to turn increased productivity from being an enemy of workers to an ally. Because when a coal miner or any other worker knows that increased productivity doesn't jeopardize their job security, they're free to become even that much more productive. They know they're not working themselves out of a job. But Consol Energy had other plans. And the ink had barely dried on the 1988 contract when Consol began transferring ownership of hundreds of millions of tons of reserves from one subsidiary to another subsidiary to another, sometimes creating whole new companies out of thin air, just to be able to avoid their responsibility to miners like Greg Yankee. Even though Consol has been using the profits that Greg and his co-workers made for them to build bigger and newer mines just 30 miles down the road. And other companies did roughly the same. Peabody Holding establishes Premier Mining and claims it has no relationship at all to Peabody Coal. Ziegler Coal Holding Company purchases Shell Oil's U.S. coal mines, renames it SMC Mining, and claims it has no ties to Ziegler's other operations. Now, to the company, it may be legal paper shuffling, but to Greg, it's a corporate shell game, and coal miners lose every single time that it's played. And that's why Greg and 14,000 coal miners just like him are on strike today. And it's the reason why more could be out on strike before the summer's out. But while miners like Greg are walking a picket line because the company's fighting to make the union part of the past, there's another coal mine not far away from Shoemaker Number 9. It's just past the state line in Pennsylvania, and it's called Maple Creek. And at Maple Creek, the workers in their union are a part of the future. Now, Bobby Gatos works at Maple Creek, and same as Greg, he can talk about how they've increased productivity and efficiency, but that's about where the similarity ends. Because the owners of Maple Creek, that's U.S. Steel Mining, made a different choice than Consol. Where Consol decided its workers were expenses to be cut and used the profits our members generated to set up new non-union mines, U.S. Steel Mining took a totally different path. Faced with a mine that was losing money, with old equipment, and with working conditions so poor that it was ranked one of the 50 most dangerous coal mines in America, U.S. Steel could have easily closed Maple Creek down. And in fact, they were planning on doing just that. But instead, the company people at the mine and folks like Bobby Gatos took a big gamble. They decided to see if the union and the company could work together. Now, I'm not talking about the creation of some company-mandated employee involvement program. That was tried once at Maple Creek. Bobby and our other members took one look at it, sized it up as an effort of less of an effort to involve us workers than it was to pacify us. No, what we embarked working together at Maple Creek was something entirely different. We called it Relationship by Objective, RBO. And it began with rank-and-file mine workers and the company's own frontline management with their conscious recognition that both wanted the same thing, job security, respect, a safe mine, and a better work environment. It began with both understanding that if we're going to survive, we had to move beyond sneering at each other. But maybe most important, it began with the understanding that labor management cooperation only works when workers have standing, that the security of union representation provides workers the strength they need to guarantee that any cooperative program is just that, a program based on trust and authentic cooperation, not coercion and capitulation. And because of it, for the first time ever, guys like Bobby Gatos, local union president, a trained union safety committeeman, are part of the process. Because of it, the mine superintendent understands our members' concerns more than he ever did before. And because of RBO, workers and managers are working together to plan Maple Creek's future development. 10 years have been added to the mine's estimated life, and already 128 laid-off UMWA coal miners have been called back to work there. And Maple Creek has gone from being a $10 million a year loser in 1991 to a $7.2 million profit maker just last year. And remember how Maple Creek ranked number 50 on the list of the most dangerous mines in America? Well, it's now dropped to number 250, and we're making it safer every single day. Given the success of Maple Creek, it should come as no surprise that other companies wanted to develop the same kind of relationship U.S. Steel Mining is building with us. And that's the reason why last fall, U.S. Steel Mining, together with the Drummond Company and Jim Walters Resources and Westmoreland Coal Company, broke ranks with the Consols and the Peabodys and the Zieglers to form their own independent bargaining alliance to negotiate with the union. And why just last week, while Consol and Peabody were blasting the mine workers with newspaper ads the way they always have, we were able to settle an agreement with this new alliance. It's an agreement that guarantees that 100% of the newly created jobs will go to UMWA members. It's an agreement that brings both the union and the company together to develop a managed health care system for workers and their families without any cuts in benefits. And for the first time ever, worker empowerment, real labor cooperation based on equality of strength, will be part of a collective bargaining contract in the coal industry. Last week, when we announced our settlement with the companies in this new alliance, I was asked by one reporter if it in fact isn't true that these companies are smaller than Consol and Peabody and Zieglers. And it's true. They are. And that's the whole point. They're smaller companies today, but they want to be big companies tomorrow. And they know that the way you achieve that isn't through beating down your workforce, it's by building up your workforce. Investing in innovative labor relations the same way you would new technology. What these companies understand is that what was demonstrated at Maple Creek is what economists like Charles Brown and James Medoff have been documenting for some time now. That not only are union companies on the whole more productive, more competitive than their non-union counterparts, union companies where cooperative programs are in place are the most productive of any. All anyone needs to do is to look at Germany to see how worker empowerment promotes world-class economic performance. But the tragedy in the American coal industry, as in so many other industries, is that while many corporations engage in the rhetoric of labor management cooperation, only a handful, are really prepared for the reality of it. There was a survey done back in 1971 that found that fewer than half of all union leaders believed they had any responsibility at all for productivity. That was 22 years ago, and the labor movement has moved well beyond that kind of thinking. We know that an adversarial system of labor relations is a good way to divide wealth, but it's not the best way to create it. We understand that. But our experience in the labor movement is that most employers still don't. Most continue to believe that workers should be hired from the neck up, from the neck down, I mean, and not the neck up. Would like for them to hire us from the neck up. And as evidenced by their total opposition to striker replacement legislation, too many still share an almost religious conviction that unions only impede competitiveness and can never enhance it. This despite evidence that manufacturing alone, union companies average a 24% productivity advantage over their non-union counterparts. We've seen how labor and management can work together. We know it works in Germany, in Scandinavia. We've seen it work right here at home at Maple Creek and with the UMWA and GM at Saturn. And we're seeing it again in the new relationship being forged every day between the Clothing and Textile Workers Union and Xerox. For every Saturn or Maple Creek and every Xerox, every instance where an employer decides to become more competitive by joining together with its workforce, there are many more examples of companies like Caterpillar and Consol. Companies who set corporate priorities as if their workers are their own worst enemies when we should be their best friends. When we see those images of men and women standing out on a picket line somewhere, whether it's auto workers or coal miners at Peabody or building janitors, the members of the service employees who protest outside this very building every day. Too many Americans think of it as someone else's fight, when really, all of us share a stake in how these disputes are resolved. Because when any employer, any manufacturer, any coal operator, any building cleaning contractor, any newspaper publisher attempts to stay competitive by reducing the living standards of his workforce, everyone loses. Well, the workers' loss, oh, that's pretty obvious. But what about the community? We lose twice. Once with lost tax revenue, and a second time when public dollars ultimately make up the cost of those lost health benefits and pension benefits and wages. But it's not just the workers and not just the community, because in the final analysis, business loses too. Because same as Maple Creek's demonstrate how an empowered and involved workforce enhances economic performance, so too does an exploited, weakened, an embattled workforce diminish it. You can measure it in higher employee turnover, higher absenteeism, higher health care costs, higher accident rates, lower productivity. Again, it's something our competitors in Europe and Japan have understood for a long, long time. The only question is, how long will it take before corporate America does as well? Much of American business is still governed by theories of workplace organization designed for a union and a world market that haven't existed for over two generations. I've seen it in coal mines, where workers operate millions of dollars of complex mining equipment in a workplace still organized for a time when miners carried a pick and carried a shovel. You won't find too many people in business or management who will argue the philosophy that keeping America competitive means creating new, flexible forms of work organizations. Many business leaders would even agree, I would think, that achieving that level of organization is impossible when workers are denied some kind of voice. That's why so much of the business community voiced so much concern over the NLRB's electrimation decision, the ruling that helps reaffirm the board's stand against company-dominated unions. But ultimately, the creation of substitute unions
is a poor response to the crisis facing American industry, as is doing nothing at all. Workers need a voice, absolutely true. But we also need the strength and the security to guarantee that ours is a voice of an equal partner in a process we share an equal stake in. And that's why the Cesar Chavez Workplace Fairness Act and ultimately labor law reform itself are so important. Not because it will help organize labor as an institution, but because it will strengthen the right of every American worker, to have their voice heard and listened to. Now, there are, of course, some who see things differently. In fact, I noticed over the weekend that Pat Buchanan took some R&R from the culture war, to write that, quote, "For Rich Trumka's, the Cesar Chavez bill would make organizing strikes risk-free acts of extortion and blackmail." Well, with an attitude like that, I don't expect you'll find Pat signing up to be a picket captain down at the Newspaper Guild office anytime soon. But my concern isn't so much with the voices on the fringe. It's more with those in the middle, people who might not even see themselves as being necessarily pro-union, but who know that America desperately needs a national strategy to become competitive again. Bill Clinton once said that it's time America reject the zero-sum thinking of traditional labor-management relations. Now, I once heard a coal miner put it a little differently and say that labor relations in this country is like watching two billy goats butt heads until they both walk off with headaches. Well, I think they're both right. But the kind of change needed in labor-management relations, the kind of change it's going to take to turn more losing businesses into success stories like Maple Creek, requires national leadership. Bill Clinton has pointed the way. Bob Reich has pointed the way. Organized labor and innovative businesses all over our nation are doing the same. And that's why our message to America is, don't support the Cesar Chavez Act and labor law reform and worker empowerment because you're pro-union. Do it because you're pro-industry. Do it because you're pro-competition. Do it because you know that where workers have a voice, everyone wins. Do it because it's time we put the era of adversarial headbutting, brain-dead labor relations behind us. Do it because if we're going to compete with the Germans, we had better start learning a little from the Germans. Do it because collective bargaining means hope and opportunity and better lives for millions of workers. Do it for guys like Greg Yankee. Do it because America needs a new kind of workplace, a workplace built on trust, a workplace built on fairness, a workplace where we join together, where we plan together, where we profit together, and where we win together. That's what the mine workers are all about. That's what organized labor is all about. And that's what America can be all about once again. Thank you.